Hey, everybody. Welcome back for season two of the Broken Banquet Podcast. This season, we've got more interviews with missionaries around the world, more interviews with authors who have written amazing books about missions, and more conversations about what it means for us to abide with one another. And yes, probably a story or two about Ashley taking a walk, eating food, or having drinks with someone who she now loves. We're so glad you're back. We're glad to be back. And we hope that you will enjoy this episode.
Dog.
Ba-ba-bum.
Hello, Ashley. Hello, Ashley.
Hello, Will.
How are you?
I'm not beside you to poke you anymore, but doing fine.
My left arm appreciates the fact that you went back to Shreveport.
Well, fine. Fine.
Just my left arm. The rest of us is really upset that you're not here anymore, but my left arm is cool with it.
All right.
Yeah. So, hey, Ashley, you want to introduce our guest?
Would love to. Remember the time we talked to Stephanie Robinson of Faith to Action?
Yes, I do.
It was episode number 2 of season 2. Mm-hmm. Well, I had a wonderful conversation with her boss shortly after that interview because we were talking back and forth about Haiti and different things that we could do for Dorée Children's Home and whatnot. And it led to a very fruitful conversation. Her name is Ellie. We had a lovely talk. And at the end of our chat, she said, "You know who you need to have on the Broken Banquet Podcast?" And I said, "Ellie, Who do I need to have on the Broken Banquet Podcast?" And she said, "This fella named Nathan Nelson. He lives in Portland, Oregon, and he is a missions pastor at the church there. And I think that you two would have a lot to talk about." And I said, "Boom, done. Let me send off a little request." And that is the extent of the conversation.
Well, thank you, Nathan, for agreeing. I got to say, one of the things that I've loved the most about this podcast is just the way that we've gotten connected to different people through different people. You know, we had a pretty short list when we started this 50 episodes ago of who we were going to talk to. And here we are, and the list just continues to grow because people who have either been on an episode or through conversations like you just described, Ashley, have said, "Hey, you know, there's someone really interesting that I know that you should talk to." So, Nathan, thank you for being one of those people, and thank you for responding positively to Ashley's invitation.
Absolutely. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, Nathan, would you just be interested, since I gave you about just the entire bio that I had on you? I should have gone to the website and sounded really smart about who Nathan is and given all of his credentials, and I didn't do that. I need to research better. We need a research intern, Will.
Can we get a producer first?
Yeah, okay, that's fine. Yeah.
Thank you.
Definitely. So, Nathan, who are you?
Yes, Nathan Nelson. I am the pastor of Mission and Outreach at Bethany Community Church up here in Seattle. I am from Portland, Oregon, originally. Yep, grew up there. Been in Seattle for over a decade now. My wife, Macy, and I called this place home since college and been serving in this capacity in the church for about 8 years.
Awesome.
And you mentioned Ellie. Ellie was my predecessor here at the church. And so I began my tenure at Bethany as an intern in the mission department under Ellie's leadership and kind of have sought to steward the philosophy of mission that she instilled and then just grow our reach and our ability to sort of integrate that philosophy of mission, how we live out our lives on mission at the church, into all aspects of the church. We can talk more about that. I also, I'm a graduate from Fuller Theological Seminary. I have my Master of Divinity, as well as a focus in international development and urban studies. And then I'm a contributor to the book Reimagining Short-Term Missions, and kind of steward and speak on behalf of the message of that book as well.
Well, let's definitely come back to that. But I want to hear more about, let's talk about this mission philosophy that Ellie had developed. Let's talk about that first, and then let's talk about how you took it and ran with it.
Yeah, absolutely. like many churches, I think in the early 2000s, Bethany got a hold of the book When Helping Hurts.
Sure.
And that book really built on Bryant Myers's work of Walking with the Poor at Fuller, served as a super formational text for us as a church. Prior to Ellie being here, we, like many other churches, had a mission committee of volunteers who'd been doing it for multiple decades. Those folks were a part of stewarding requests that would come in and did the best that they could to try to engage strategically. Now, in that time, when Ellie arrived at the church, there were funds going out to 100 plus organizations, different people, some that still had some connection to the church and some that didn't. And so her job was really to come in and say, okay, what is, when we say mission, what do we mean? And we knew that core to the foundation of our missiology as a church was going to be this notion of mutual transformation and holistic mission. Mm-hmm. A lot of the language around that today is integral mission. And so for sure, we wanted to have structures, programs that supported those two core philosophies. We wanted to be a part of using the assets that God had given us as a church to engage in his mission in the world, locally, globally, in effective ways. But we also wanted the various vulnerable people that we were engaging with to be as much a part of our formation as we are a part of theirs. And so that notion of mutual transformation was super foundational and has only grown since in terms of how we express that. And then the other piece of what does it look like to be strategic? What does it look like in the midst of all that God is doing in, you know, to make God's mission a reality in the world? What is Bethany? What is our church's role in that? And so it started with this framework of partnership being kind of the way forward for us in mission. So that notion of partnership I've sort of brought in and scaled. And so we have what we call global mission partners, which are organizations, not individuals, but organizations that we partner with for a long period of time in kind of strategic geographic areas of focus. And so we have three of those currently, and we've been with each of those partners for more than a decade. And then we also have local partners, which again are organizations that we serve with for 10 plus years at a time, some newer than that, but no end in sight. And the goal for us and all of our local partnerships is that they would be mutually transformative. And so rather than just give money to an organization for them to go do the work over there, and then we sort of refer them volunteers, we build programming together. And so we ask the question, what unique assets do we as a church have to bring to the table? What unique assets does the organization, like a refugee resettlement organization, for example, and how can we leverage the best of both of those to serve the most effective way possible? And so we have what I call that shared programming. We have shared programming with all of our partners locally and then unique kind of expressions of that globally as well. And then a third bucket for us missionally is what we call our supported missionaries. Now that's, again, those are individuals who feel an express sense of call to a unique field of God's mission in the world that requires fundraising. It's not paid by conventional means. We're very, very intentional in our language. We want everybody to see that whatever it is that they do can be in participation with God's mission in the world. From business executives to teachers to stay-at-home moms. And so it's people, and some missions that God has for us don't get paid by conventional means. And so that's where we come in and support those vocations as a church. And we call that our supported missionaries program.
I think you should be the one doing the podcast.
I do too. I thought that. I was like, I'm so unworthy now.
No, I mean, it sounds like a really healthy, thoughtful understanding of mission and missional relationships. I'm curious to know, and some of this may have happened before you got there, but the transition from what missions was at the church to what it is now. How much resistance was there? Was that a struggle, or was it something that kind of everybody read When Helping Hurts and were like, yep, and so now here you are? I mean, how much, because one of the things I think Ashley and I both have bumped into personally and have heard from others that, you know, people, they kind of like doing things the way they've done them and the relationships that they've formed the way that they've formed them. And it's hard when someone has invested so much of themselves for an extended period of time to sit down with them and say, so, you know, that actually might not be as helpful and healthy as you think it is. So have you gotten a sense for what that process was like at the church?
Yeah, I'll kind of speak to two parts of it. One that is sort of predates my involvement and then kind of my work specifically within that. So Ellie, as we've talked about her, one of the leaders of Faith to Action, has an affinity for transitions, helping people through transitions, because her work now, of course, with Faith to Action is to help institutionalize care for orphans and vulnerable children transition to a more family-based care model. I am part of speaking on behalf of advocating for that type of work. It's the kind of work that we support as a church locally and globally in that space. That being said, that's a really hard thing to do. People have been supporting their orphanages, for example, their whole lives, you know, feeling that this is the thing that God called them to. And now someone or someones are telling me that's not the best way. Mm-hmm. It's a really tough pill to swallow. So bless her heart, 100%. Ellie has an affinity for that, and it's amazing. There were really hard conversations in those early days for her to help kind of wrangle in, center not just on a philosophy, but then a structure that could live that philosophy out as I sort of described it. Mm-hmm. I am blessed to have been able to inherit it at a stage where the executive senior leadership of the church, the council, were on board. Yes, we trust this. We bless it. We want to move forward with it. That being said, when I inherited it, mission was largely a silo within the church. And that's something that's very normal for any department of the church to say. In our case, for sure, it was like there was a need under Ellie's leadership to uphold a level of standard to say, you know, if a mission trip, for example, or some kind of program locally is not in alignment with these notions of partnership and mutual transformation, holistic mission, then, you know, we can't do it. We're not going to do that. We're going to uphold this standard. Well, after a certain amount of time and people getting enough no's, it can start to feel like, okay, mission is just going to do its own thing over there. Me, part of my wiring, my gifting, my personality is I am a convener of people. And so it was really my passion to take this amazing philosophy, truly incredible programs and structure, and make it integrated with how we understand ourselves to be as a whole church. And so a couple of different fronts that I've had to approach in that regard, which you start to bump up. People say at one level, yeah, we're on board. We love this notion of mutual transformation. But when you start to talk about what that looks like for a children's ministry to engage with unhoused folks in a way that's not just sort of a one-off gift that you're going to give during the holidays, but actually has some relationship and some learning in there, it gets uncomfortable. It gets hard to imagine what that can look like. Is it safe? How do we disrupt our curriculum that we've had planned for the last 2-3 years for something like this to fit into it? So what I try to do is help put on a creative imagination to go, at the end of the day, mission is a discipleship issue as much as everything else. And if we want to be fully formed disciples, we have to be creating bridges across otherness. We have to be thinking very intentionally about what it is to not just sit in a pew on a Sunday and call that Christianity, but to go, what does it look like to open my whole life to who it is that Christ is shaping me to be through relationships with people who look nothing like me, sound like nothing like me, are in a totally different income bracket, have a different nationality, all of those things. So I would say the challenge for me I have not had to confront ideology so much as practice. How do we practice this in ways that people can really do with the time that they have? How do we do this? How do we reimagine ourselves as a church so that we're not just putting on Sunday, but that we're imagining living missionally in and through everything that we do every day of the week? And part of that is, you know, the language shift that we have around missionaries. We really want people to understand, we called it the Faith and Work Initiative, that we can help people understand the way in which whatever their vocation is, it can be in participation with God's mission in the world. But we got to understand what that mission is. We got to talk about it. And so that might be, I might have danced around it a little bit, but does that answer your question?
Yeah. I'm just thinking a lot about just my own personal situation. Nathan, I'm just a normal person who happens to be serving in the mission field. I was really hesitant when I graduated from seminary and was invited by the Methodist Church of Costa Rica to come and work alongside them here to even refer to myself as a missionary, mostly because I knew missionaries who were going places that were going to be way harder than me. And so I just like that's what they get to be. I'm just lucky. I've considered those things sort of on a personal level, but I hadn't really taken a whole lot of time to consider how that sounds to the rest of the church and even a calling to the ministry, like defining a calling to pastoral ministry in sort of in opposition to the calling to just be faithful servants that all of us are called to. Like I joke that I had the vaguest calling in the world, work for me every day. Well, that's for everybody, you know? So there's really nothing that's distinct about me except I have a passport with a whole bunch of stamps in it. But other than that, I'm really a pretty normal person. Well, that's debatable. But I appreciate your thoughtfulness. And you mentioned just the language, the shift in language. And that's something that Ashley and I have talked a lot about is, you know, when we refer to these relationships that we're committed to and calling them things like faithful friendships, mm-hmm. or when Ashley comes to spend time with us here, it's a family reunion more than anything else. And that stuff matters because it helps people break out of those molds that are so ingrained of white heroes going somewhere to fix things for people. Mm-hmm. So I just really appreciate how careful you all seem to be about every aspect of that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I wonder too, I went through a lot of the same things about 10 years ago of how do we make this shift into a transformational mission type model. Can you talk about a few of those tangible things that you did to help that model transition?
Yeah. You know, when I started, we had two global partners and really kind of one and a half, I guess you could say two local partners. And the amount that we were investing globally was significantly more, both in terms of finances as well as just focus, than it was in local missional efforts. And Ellie had begun an effort, and I have since really tried to take it on myself to bring more equity in those two areas. And so one of the things that I'm super passionate about is the integration of our global and local missional endeavors. You know, the world is increasingly globalized. More and more, it's almost impossible to talk about any one place in the world without direct connection to another place in the world. I think that's true of the mission of God as well, and it's beautiful. As much as it's an opportunity for us, I think it can, our propensity to sort of want to fully conceptualize, box in, commodify even as church leaders, the work that we are doing so that people feel good about it and they give to the church and we can keep doing it, gets in our way. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is really draw direct lines of connection between things happening globally and things happening locally. Mm-hmm. And that's to help people understand at a discipleship level how huge our God is, right? The global church, things like that. And so in all of our partnerships, it's not about what Bethany does in another part of the world or in another part of the city. It's not just about what our partner does in that place either. It's about what we are doing together, but more importantly, it's about what we are doing as a larger movement of the global church, what we are doing in direct collaboration with other local churches as well. Whenever we talk about any of our partnerships, like the one we have in Rwanda, for example, with World Relief, I say we are one of about eight other churches from the Western world who support different regions within the country of Rwanda and the work that's happening. It's not a story of what Bethany is doing to transform Rwanda. Mm-hmm. God's transforming Rwanda. We are a part of this amazing organization working in communities with local churches that are changing their communities, right? And so what I say is we don't have anything to fear about somehow that taking away from our identity as a church and the work. No, it's a better story to tell. It's a truer story to tell. And so I think one of the things that hit me in the face early on in my ministry here at Bethany was we need to tell a true story. We need to tell a whole story, and we need to tell a compelling story, because if it's God's story, it should be compelling, right? And so in this global to local connection piece, that's where I've really started to see opportunity for that. For example, our work in Rwanda is all about uniting local churches to and equipping them to address the most acute needs of poverty in their context, in their neighborhoods, in their villages. I took me traveling to Rwanda several times before I got the idea, what if we did that in Seattle? What if local churches could actually get together, be united, God forbid, and actually do something that moved the needle on the well-being of the most vulnerable people in our community? So we started what we call our Sacred Streets Coalition, inspired by the model that World Relief uses for uniting local churches around the world, of churches in our area on a corridor called the Aurora Corridor, which is home to the highest concentration of sex and drugs trafficking in the Northwest. And we said, what would it look like for us to embody compassion for those who are caught in those things and who are unhoused? And so together as local churches, we've united around this. It's directly inspired by our work in Rwanda. We say the church in Rwanda taught us everything that we needed to know. Mm-hmm. And we are kind of wrestling through, what does it look like for us to be united as different backgrounds, all of those things? And what does it look like not just to say we're friends, but to actually be on mission together? Yes. So we have a partner organization that we support and that equips us and that we build shared programming with. And there's all kinds of testimonies of relationships between people who never would have met one another because of this type of work. So I use that as an illustration. We have now 8 local partners. Again, we had just about 1.5 or 2 when I started. All of those local partnerships fit into kind of 5 areas of focus that we have for local mission. Each of those areas of focus are shared with our global partners as well.
Good.
And so you can imagine it's things like orphans and vulnerable children. So we have a foster care ministry and a special needs ministry we call Belong here in the city, and partnerships that support that and programs. We also support organizations globally that are doing family strengthening, holistic work for the most vulnerable children. So you can kind of see how what we try to do is tell a consistent story. Regardless of whether it's in Costa Rica, we have a partnership in Costa Rica as well, or if it's in Rwanda, or if it's in Seattle on the Aurora Corridor.
Yeah. Love that.
2 things. One is that's so wise, because doing it that way where you're making those connections, it keeps the partners and the people you're in ministry with who aren't in Seattle from so easily becoming the other. Because the kind of ministry is consistent between the two. That's just a fantastic tool to keep that from happening. But then you said something a minute ago that I wanted to go back to just briefly, when you talked about how the things that are being done, that it's not you doing them, it's not the church, that it's God is doing these things, we just get to be a part of it, and how easy it is for missions to become an idol. And if your mission understanding is we go somewhere and we've built so many churches, or we've built so many schools, or we've baptized so many people, who's being glorified in that? We are. Mm-hmm. And I think the Bible speaks pretty clearly about how wrongheaded that is. But by doing it this other way, you know, it's regardless of who we're doing it with, and the things that are being accomplished in the kingdom, it's God who's being glorified for them. So all of that is just, man, you haven't said anything yet that we can like kind of pick apart. I don't know.
I don't think that's true. You just don't have enough time.
Well, I'm sitting here because I'm going to be transitioning soon from one position to another position. And I'm sitting here going, I need to make sure that Will gets this podcast edited very quickly. And I want to listen to it over and over and over and over again about how you've made this transition. Because I do think that language is probably the biggest thing the mission pastor does, is that education of uniting the language that everybody is speaking the same language. Mm-hmm. That's so hugely important, especially when you're trying to communicate what it is that we are, what it is that we do.
And what it is that we're not, and what it is that we're not doing. I say to the teams every week that come down here to be with us, one of the biggest reasons why a lot of people have such a negative impression of, you know, short-term missions and that kind of stuff is because we've done such a poor job talking about it. We just say the wrong things. And so a lot of times there are cases in what we're actually doing needs to be addressed, but there's a lot of cases where the relationships were good, but we just talked about it in a way that was so unhealthy, it gave people this really twisted understanding of what we think the church thinks the mission, you know, missions is. And so that's one of, I think, the most important things that I do, and I'll just call myself a missionary now, as a missionary, hosting volunteers, you know, throughout the year, is teaching them a different way to think about it, but more importantly, to talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as I would love to go home with each team and sit down and have coffee with every member of their church and talk about this stuff, obviously I can't do that. So I need you all to go home and use the right words. You know?
Two things came up for me as both of you were sharing. One is this idea that when we started talking more commonly about mission needing to be holistic, the mistake there is to just try to rebrand what you're already doing to be, quote, holistic. And then you try to be everything to everybody. And really, that's impossible for all of us, right? And so while I say it's a value of ours as a church that we uphold holistic mission, it doesn't mean we do everything, right? We do a lot. We do. But we have to understand the limits of that. And so that's where I say we have these five areas of focus. And so particularly for local mission, but they all find expression in our global mission as well. And when we say, like, I'm very careful when I say, you know, the gifts that you give to Bethany support the work that we're doing in the city and around the world. I'm not saying just simply around the world. I'm like in a few specific places in the world, right? Let's be realistic. It's not Bethany. It's not insert your church name or your mission organization and like, the whole world is blessed by us. We need to be specific. Otherwise, I think we run the risk of sort of diluting the significance of what we do. Okay. So I think something that can be really helpful, and I do consulting work with other mission pastors and organizations on this, is to really, it's a discernment process. God, who are you shaping us to be? And how are you inviting us to uniquely participate in your mission in the world? So we have these areas of focus. One, it's refugees and vulnerable immigrants, local schools, foster adoption and special needs, historically marginalized communities, which for us is parts of the city that are victims of redlining, as well as the native communities here. And then the other one is the unhoused. And so within those areas of focus, we have at least one local partner. And under each of those partners, I have a lay leader who leads a whole variety of different programs. And that's where our people plug in. And those are those shared programs we build with our partners. Now, I bring this kind of level of detail up to say, I never talk about from the front on a Sunday morning what I just shared with you, because you lose people, right? I may have lost you even in the first sentence that I said. But what we do instead is we talk about the shared mission that we have. And so people who go to Bethany should know that we extend hospitality to the stranger. Sometimes that's us talking about a program with asylum seekers at the border. Sometimes that's us talking about welcoming and resettling a refugee family in our neighborhood. The program's not what's important. What's important is the essence of the call, right? And so that's where I think we can help with it. As we grow our missional footprint and we're able to have expression in a diversity of areas, it's really important for us to come back to that kind of core story, that core calling. And that kind of helps people fit together what these things are. So this, just one last example, is super important in short-term missions, I think. When I speak on short-term missions, I say short-term mission trips are a tool. They are not the mission. Hard stop. Not every tool is fit for every project, but some projects are impossible without certain tools. And so, what's your project? What's your mission? Is a short-term mission trip the appropriate tool in that? If it is, praise God. Do it well. Do it with all the mutual transformation and holistic mission in mind that you possibly can, with relationships at the core and everything else. And don't, when you, to your point, when you come back, tell people about your mission trip. Don't tell, on Tuesday we did this, on Thursday we did that, and then I had ice cream and blah. It's like, are you kidding me? You're selling short, to your point, the essence of the deal here. Talk about the partnership that you have with the place. Talk about what God is already doing there and how you see God come to life through your relationship with that place. Talk about what's going to be different 10 years from now, because you're going to be in the game with that long-term commitment towards transformation. Talk about how you're different as a result and how you and your ministry at your church is different, right? That's the story, not the mission trip itself. But unfortunately, we tell the story of our mission trips all the time and no one cares. Really, no one cares.
Ashley, have I told the story of the girls going through immigration on here yet?
No, you haven't. No, do tell.
So Nathan, one of the things that I've been saying to people that we are in partnership with for a long time now is that hopefully when someone asks you about your mission trip, you know, what'd you do in Costa Rica, that you will say to them, we were church. Mm-hmm. And then I'll talk about these five things that I think are what kind of make a church, and how all of those five things should happen while you're here with us. And so say that first and talk about those things. What did the worship feel like? What did the prayer feel like? What did the fellowship with people here feel like? You know, the witness that you had in this community, serving and being served, all of those things. And then talk about, you know, how many bags of concrete we mixed that week or whatever. But don't talk about that first, because you're giving people the impression that that's the most important thing about your mission trip was concrete, right? So tell them we're being church. So last summer we had a youth group here from North Carolina, and the youth pastor sent me an email a week or two after they got home. And he said, well, I just thought you'd want to know, when we were going through immigration in Miami, I think they must have been sisters because they all went together to see the immigration officer. And your first question, where are you coming from? And they all said Costa Rica. And second question, what were you doing in Costa Rica? And all three of them in unison said, we were being church. And I thought, yes, you got it. It took 20 years, but somebody finally got the answer right.
You told that story to the team that was there last week. So I'm very, very curious, and I want to know if my people came back going, we got to be the church this week. So
yeah,
can't wait. I hope so too.
So Nathan, the name of this podcast is The Broken Banquet. And the reason why we named it that is sort of in recognition that we have all been invited to this perfect, holy, heavenly banquet. And as perfect and holy and heavenly as it is, we here on earth have busted it all up. And our hope is that one of the things that maybe, just maybe, can repair some of the brokenness at this table is a right understanding of missions and missional relationships. Are there experiences that you've had locally or internationally with the different partnerships that you all have at the church, things you've seen in church members that are involved at different degrees or in these communities that you feel like are evidence of that? Basically, I'm just asking you to affirm that we're on to something.
I love the language of the banquet.
Yeah.
Often, it's hard for me to give a sermon without talking about the kingdom of God. And it's hard for me to talk about the kingdom of God without using the illustration of the banquet. I'm just going to riff on that for 1 second because I just love it so much. But my grandma on my dad's side, we called her Layla. She would always host the family dinners before she passed, and Christmas, Easter, all that. And so when we go over to Layla's house, one of my favorite things as a kid was to go and look and see. She would always put a nameplate at everyone's seat around the table, but every time it was different. So she would mix up who you're sitting by and that kind of thing. And so I just remember going to these feasts as a family and eager to see, where's my nameplate? Where's the place? And for me, that's such a beautiful kind of illustration of, I think, just a little bit of what the kingdom is like. This table that's set for us, your nameplate is at a seat, you know? So God has set a seat for you. And for so much of what I think we get to do, and it breaks our hearts at times in mission, is we are aware that there's a lot of empty seats at the table with a whole lot of names, but no butts in those seats. And so for me, I think one of the my favorite things that happens, and again, it's like, how much time do you have? There's so much that I could say that I think illustrates this. And it's not about tooting the horn of Bethany's missions or whatever. Like, it's not about that, right? This is about what God has done, and we had no imagination for this. Just trying to be faithful along the way. But a huge moment, there's been several, but I'll talk about one, is when people are coming to the table and taking the seat that God has prepared for them. And that happens, I think, when we have historically marginalized groups getting to lead in the way that God designed them to do. And so often in our missional efforts, there's people who look like me. I'm a white guy up in front, you know, preaching or something like that, or lecturing or whatever it may be. Well, we, like I mentioned earlier, through our partnership in Rwanda, have learned so much about what it is for the church to be united. Everyone knows the story of Rwanda in 1994, genocide, 1 million people die in less than 100 days. The country's 99% Christian, so that's Christians killing Christians. How does that happen? That's not the testimony of Rwanda today. The testimony of Rwanda today is a united people that say, we are one people, one Rwanda, and in the church, people say, we are one church. Mm. And World Relief has been foundational in that movement. And so for us, it's not just we are one people, but what's so beautiful is that one of the reasons they come together is, yes, their shared identity in Christ, but also the conviction that all the great need they see in their communities is not for some agency to come solve, right, from some multinational corporation to fix or whatever it is, but for them as local churches to address the most acute needs in their community. They can be the solution to poverty as the church. And so anyway, I started getting my head and heart around this idea in my visits to our partners in Rwanda, and started to ask those questions for us locally. And at a certain point, we kind of built a similar network of churches. We had a partner like World Relief that was sort of equipping us to embody best practices as we're trying to extend compassion to our unhoused neighbors, all that stuff. And it occurred to me, you know, the only reason that we caught the fire for this vision is because we got to see the testimony of the church in Rwanda on display. And we always get to send teams there. We have the financial means to do so, et cetera. So I thought, what if they could have the opportunity to come here and do a reverse mission trip, if you will? So this was a multi-year process thwarted by COVID and these different things. But finally, at long last, after a few years of budgeting and planning, and I can give more details to anyone who wants it on how we made this happen, but we did. We brought a team from Rwanda, of Rwandese themselves, to Seattle. They were missionaries, so to speak, to us for a week. And we had all the same objectives. There was a lot of questions of, well, what are they going to do in the time that they're here? You know, what do we do when we're there? And I said, it's the same objectives that we have for our trips there, just contextualized in reverse. And so core to our objectives for any short-term mission trip is supporting and encouraging the staff of our partner organization and the ongoing work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so we created opportunities for them to support and encourage the staff here at our church, of our partner organizations, of our little Sacred Streets Coalition of churches coming around homelessness, one of our goals when we go places is to leverage the unique assets that God has given us in flow with what his Spirit is already doing in that place. So we asked the same question here. And we said, well, these are experts in uniting the local church. Maybe they can give us a seminar on unity and collaboration in the local church. So we brought a bunch of churches in Seattle, some of which were part of our network, some that weren't. And we let them teach us about why and how the church can be unified and unique ways of identifying and addressing poverty as churches. We're better for it, right? So that those are just a couple of examples. But I think for me, that opportunity that these Rwandese who have been receiving visitors for a long time from these supporting churches in the U.S., for them to get to be the ones that go, that are in the privileged position of teaching and investing and seeing that their work, like ours, is bigger than in their own community, but a part of God's global church. It was like, yes, this is inviting people to the place at the table that God has prepared for them. It was so good. So yeah. There's an example.
No, that's fantastic. We've been doing the same thing. After Hurricane Katrina hit, we started taking mission teams from Costa Rica to the United States. We've been to Shreveport with Ashley's church. I'm in the process of planning a trip right now for a group of young adults that are going to go to North Carolina this fall. And to me, the catalyst for doing that was something that you started to mention at the very end. I realized one Sunday in our church here in Costa Rica, you know, almost 20 years ago, that the young people in that church were growing up with an understanding that mission was something that was always done from outside into their community. And that's not what Acts 1:8 is talking about. And so if we were going to be facilitating that side of the equation, we also have a responsibility to give the same opportunities to Costa Ricans to be obedient to Acts 1:8. So that's actually what our organization is called. It's Acts 1:8 Missions. And it's a recognition that, you know, we're all called to be Christ's witnesses right where we are and even to the ends of the earth, not just the gringos. It's, you know, everybody has to be obedient to that. Now, you finally said something that I disagree with slightly.
Let me hear it.
I thought you were actually going to jump in and say something. But
no, I wanted to say nice things first. I wanted to say nice things first. The first time we took a team from here to the U.S. to Biloxi, Mississippi, that team was sponsored by a church in Missouri who has a relationship with us here. They came from Missouri down to Biloxi, and we all spent the week together doing hurricane relief. And they called it a reverse mission trip. And at first, it was like, well, of course, that's natural. It makes sense. It's da-da-da. Mm-hmm. But the more I said that, the more uncomfortable I got with it, because it makes it sound like for Costa Ricans to be going out into the world in obedience to Acts 1:8, they're doing something backwards. They're doing it just as forwards as we are when we go from anywhere else. So we just call them mission trips. We've stopped calling it reverse mission trips because it almost made it sound like they're doing some other thing. And I think they're doing missions the right way, you know?
Yeah. I knew I liked you guys. It's a kindred spirit here for sure.
Yeah.
We call all of our mission trips strategic visits to our global partners. It's intentional for a lot of different reasons. When I'm speaking in something like this, I'll say mission trip just for the sake of shared language. Similarly, when we were coming up with a name for this and how we were going to talk about it, we started with like a reverse strategic visit. And it was our partner, the country director at the time, a dear friend, Moses Nahiro, who said to me, you know, Nathan, this word reverse, very problematic. And so we were super aware, and for better or worse, I've used it in settings like this just to try to help it relate for people. Sure. But I think you're right on. Like it's a strategic visit from Rwanda to Seattle or from wherever to wherever.
But I absolutely love the fact that you know, Ashley and I have asked a bunch of guests on this podcast, what's the thing that you are most excited about the folks you are serving with, wherever that is in the world, bringing to the table that's going to challenge us and teach us. But we talk about it on sort of a theoretical heavenly level, like when that happens. Mm-hmm. But you actually did it. Like you recognized that through this horrific experience that they had lived through and the way that they were able to survive it and heal from it afterwards, that there is a wealth of God's love in that that needs to be shared with the church. And to give them the opportunity to come and do that is just, that is exactly the kind of thing that I think the kind of story we've been hoping to hear. And I can't, like, I'm going to tell that story over and over and over again now when I talk about these reciprocal relationships and what it means for us to bring our gifts and our talents and our context to the table and bring the ways that God has revealed himself to us in different places, in different ways to the table. And by the way, here's an incredible example of that. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Nathan, I haven't seen Will this excited since... Wait a minute. I don't think I've ever seen him this excited.
Season one, episode one. That's not true.
Okay.
I'm super encouraged to hear you reflect that back. And like I said, far from perfect and hopefully onto something. We're all just trying to get a little closer to what it is to really live out God's mission in the world. And if you are interested, would be happy to send you a link. We have a teaser trailer that's done, and then we have a documentary, kind of a mini documentary on that whole experience that I can share with you that really tries to illustrate what happens when we try to bring to life this idea of reciprocal relationship.
Absolutely. I definitely want that for the show notes so that we can put it out there.
Yeah.
That'd be great. I had a question about 30 minutes ago, so this is going to be out of context. But when I was thinking about your reimagination of mission trips out into the world to go visit the partners who are doing things, great things, what do you call those trips for the congregation members to be able to recognize those trips?
Yeah. For us at Bethany, we call them strategic visits to our global partners. Strategic because we don't do it willy-nilly. We don't do it because you have to do mission trips to be an evangelical church in America these days. We do it because we really believe that it furthers the work of our shared partnership. Mm-hmm. And so much of that is around relationship and the value that relationship can have for both sides. We call it a visit because visit is not revolutionary language. It's just honest. That's what we're doing. We're going to visit. There's certain things that can happen in the context of a visit, and there's certain things that can't. Mm-hmm. That's good to name. And so we try to set expectations for the goer as well as the receiver, just through the language we use. That's what we do at Bethany. I would say, like, more universally, not so important that the language is the same for everybody, but that we're intentional with the language that we use, that it's in accordance with what the trip is genuinely about. And so if you think about the language of mission trip, one of the editors of our book, Reimagining Short-Term Missions, talks really, really well on this. But mission trip, okay, so this trip is about the mission of God. How many of our short-term mission trips are actually that? It's a really good question to ask ourselves. If they're actually that, call them a mission trip. But if they're not, then what are they? And name it appropriately, right? And if you're like, well, there should be a little bit more mission than learning that's in there, but learning trip probably describes it better, then you go, okay, if you don't want to call it a learning trip, you want it to have genuine mission in it, then rethink what you're doing on your trips, right? So I think it's a super helpful practice for churches, for organizations to go through and go, if we had to just describe, like, a name, what we actually do on these trips, what would it be? And then ask the question, what do we want it to be? And how are we going to get there?
Mm-hmm. Very good. Do you have the people in your congregation who go on these trips? Do you have a set of educational things that you put them through before they go on the trip?
Now we just throw them in.
Yeah.
Good luck. No. Yeah, we raised the bar pretty high on this. And part of it is because we really decided what we wanted our trips to be about. Mm-hmm. And so we have kind of core objectives that are universal to all of our strategic visits to our global partners. And the number we landed on that fits best for that is between 5 and 12 participants. Mm-hmm. So that's the number that we look for. And then we ask for a roughly 9-month commitment from people. Mm-hmm. So there's about a 3-month ramp up that includes trainings in things like When Helping Hurts, Walking with the Poor, as well as education on the partner organization, the context you're going to visit, the work that we've been doing. Like I said, we've been with all of our partners over a decade. So there's a whole lot of history that people kind of need to understand to know what their place in the story is. So we do that 3-month ramp up. We do about roughly 7 to 10 days in country. And then we ask for a 6-month, what we call an ambassadorship period when people return. So practically, that's once a month meetings for 6 months where you're debriefing your experience and asking the question of each other, how does this integrate with the rest of my life and my call to God's mission in the world day in and day out? It also includes a couple of sharing opportunities. One that's a more smaller scale sharing event, we call it, with donors and anyone from the church who wants to come. It's kind of a potluck thing. Show your photos, tell the stories. And then there's another that we call our Sunday service engagement. So one Sunday a year is devoted to each of our global partners, and teams become the primary communicators in different creative ways about how that partnership. We ask them, if you were to distill one common theme from your experience that's applicable to everybody in the congregation, regardless of whether they go on a trip. This is not about recruiting people for a trip. It's about discipling our community. What is that core theme and how can you communicate it effectively? And so they become the folks to do that, and they work with our staff in that. Yeah, so I think what's a core piece for all of our short-term trips is that we see the role of any trip participant as being an ambassador. Mm-hmm. You're an ambassador of the church to our partners when you go, and you're an ambassador of the partnership between our church and the organization and the community they serve when you come back.
I constantly gripe about the teams that a lot of them don't spend any time. Like they'll prepare for the trip before they come. I feel like you should spend at least that much time after the trip, and you guys are doing twice as much time. You're right. It's a high level of commitment, but there should be a high level of commitment, mm-hmm. especially if we're trying to break out of the kind of volunteerism mode of what this is about. You know, the easiest way to get people to stop doing things for the wrong reasons is to just make it really hard for them to do it at all.
Totally. And, you know, practically, I felt the pressure when I started, like, you know, there would be a handful of people on each of these trips. And from some of our senior leaders, it was like, are these trips not successful? And I had to help reframe what success is, right? And now, yes, we have buy-in 100%, but it didn't come easy. Like, if you send 50 youth on a mission trip to Mexico every year, people will praise you. Maybe not on this podcast, but in the rest of the church, right?
Exactly.
And so the question becomes, how do we reorient ourselves around genuine mission and what the appropriate metrics of success look like towards that end?
I get asked by people all the time who are really, you know, they're on our calendar and they're trying to put a team together, and they'll send me an email. They're really discouraged because they've only got 5 people signed up. I'm like, only didn't even need to be a part of that description. You got 5 people signed up. Can't wait to see you. You know,
it's great.
But it clashes with that sort of historical model. And we've got a lot of big teams that come, especially in the summers when the youth groups can come. And, you know, the tension for me is, you know, Ashley was just here last week with 11 people. So we got a lot of one-on-one time with those 11 people. We've got a couple of weeks this summer that we'll have 60 people here at the Missions and Ministry Center. I know there are people who will go home at the end of that week that I won't have had a one-on-one conversation with while they were here. And I regret that, but I don't regret it so much that I would rather they just not come at all and just bring a group of 10, right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully what they're going to do is they're going to, and maybe, you know, one-on-one conversations with me are not desirable for the people that come down here. But I hope that they'll come down here and enjoy it so much, and it'll mean so much to them that they'll come back again and again and again. And eventually we'll have that conversation, you know? Mm-hmm. So there, you know, it's for us as a ministry, it's been a challenge of finding that balance. When we first started in 2003, and it was just a handful of teams each year, and they were small teams, and we were focused on one thing, and it was really easy. Mm-hmm. And now we're hosting 35 to 40 teams a year, and it's all year long, and we've got all these different areas of ministry where we're plugged into the community that we've been called to, and it's made things exponentially more complicated for me on a personal level, but it means we're involving exponentially more people, and mm-hmm. and so we love this time of year, January, February, March, because it's usually one or two teams a month, and they're usually smaller teams. And so we loved having that time with them. We also love the summer because it's like summer camp all week long, and there's so much excitement and people from different parts of the country that are, you know, meeting randomly on a mission trip to Costa Rica. And then every year after that, they schedule the same week so they can come and have a reunion here in Costa Rica. And mm-hmm. and so we've tried to, instead of just writing off one or the other, try and find the ways that God can be moving in both of those mm-hmm. situations. But I think the commitment part that you mentioned is applicable to both. Mm-hmm. You know, there should be a high standard. I send a reading list to every team that's going to come down here. I don't think very many of them read the book. Some people do.
I need to get that list. I haven't got that list.
We've interviewed most of the people that are on it, actually. So, I mean, you know the book. I know you've read the books. If I had read a book that I thought you needed to read, I would have told you to read it. I do need to read Nathan's book and then have him back on at some point so we can talk about reimagining mission.
Yeah. You guys, if you're interested, you'd be more than welcome to add it to the list.
Definitely. Yeah. We'll add that to the list, and then maybe we'll get Bryant Myers on too. And he wrote Walking with the Poor. It's a fantastic book.
Yeah. One of the things I love, Bryant Myers and Steve Corbett, who wrote When Helping Hurts, endorse the Reimagining Short-Term Missions book that I contributed to. But it's a collection of essays that includes people who are like sending churches, receiving communities, and facilitating organizations. So kind of each of the three major players in the short-term mission experience. And each of them writes on kind of core themes that we discussed mm-hmm. throughout the book. So... Awesome. I love that you hear a lot of the same things articulated different ways from those different groups. And that, I think, reinforces the point.
I'm writing it down. Well, Nathan, we've kept you for over an hour, and I want to be respectful of your time. But we could just keep talking if you want. It's up to you.
No, that's good. I do have something else I need to get to. But, man, really grateful for the invitation, y'all. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I can't wait to listen to this podcast over and over and over again, not just to get our listenership up, but because this has just been so quality. I've loved everything you've had to say, Nathan, and thank you for expanding my mind and challenging me as I enter into a new transition and season of life. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you for spending time with us this afternoon. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And if I may, by way of like closing blessing, just say, like, may God continue to bring all of us around the table and expand the banquet for his kingdom. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Good to be with y'all.
You too, Nathan. You too.
Bye, Ashley.
Bye, Will.
You've been listening to The Broken Banquet, a podcast by Will Bailey and Ashley Goad. Music provided by Irene and the Sleepers. Join us next week for another episode. He's prepared the table. All things are ready. Come to the feast.